Welcome everybody to my live chat. My name's Sue Larkin, and my aim in the next 45 minutes is to give you lots of practical ideas. I want you to get the most out of this call, so please print out the handout document. Now we are having some problems with our server, so you might just want to grab a pen and paper at this stage, and we're hoping we can rectify that and get those documents to you in the next couple of days. But at least if you grab some pen and paper, and I'd recommend some highlighters or coloured texters so you can take notes as I discuss the strategies. After the call, I'll be online on Facebook to take your questions and for people to discuss key points. If you haven't already, if you could just ask to friend me on Facebook so you can engage in that conversation. Well, tonight's topic is engagement and participation. And this is a topic that is actually very dear to me. In fact, it's really the reason I became interested in autism in the first place. I'm not a parent of a child with autism. People often ask me that. I'm actually a teacher. And in my first year out of teaching, I had a child with autism in my class. This was actually in the late 80s, and the government had put in a policy in Australia of inclusion and not necessarily money or resources to back it up. I know I've got some people from overseas listening tonight, and I'm sure some of you can relate to that too, where many of the specialist settings were closed down and children were put in mainstream schools. The main problem with this is many teachers hadn't had any experience or even done any special education training. Myself, I had done some disability studies, but it was mainly looking at what is autism, not what to do, which that's why engagement and participation is so important to me, because knowing what autism is one thing, but knowing what to do is the tricky part. And for parents listening too, I'm sure that you go through those questions of what do I do in this situation. So for me, I had a darling little boy in my class whose name was Michael, and he's what we would call today classic autism. He was nonverbal. He had many sensory issues looking back, but at the time I didn't understand those sensory issues. He was English as a second language. He and his nonna had a very, very close relationship. In fact, he'd been at home with her as a single child with his grandma, his nonna, and they had a very special way of engaging. So although I say he was nonverbal, he could communicate. He and grandma, his nonna, had a very special bond and way of communicating. The problem was he came to school with 25 other children and he didn't have a way to communicate with us. And that's why I'm very passionate when we're looking at teaching children to communicate. It's not just about speech. And tonight I'll talk about the use of visuals, because many children, although they have speech, doesn't mean they can communicate. And just this week I was talking to some lovely teachers at a school who have a little girl who's selective mute, who talks at home, but at school does not talk at all. And they've gone on home visits and she'll chat to them, but as soon as she walks through that school gate, she stops talking. So how do you engage these sorts of kids? What do you do to increase their participation? Anyway, back to Michael. My three biggest challenges with Michael were, first, he would run out of the room. Now, if we had a traditional school with a corridor and so forth, many children with autism will remove themselves out to the corridor. But I was in a portable classroom, or a transportable, which is up on stilts, and just literally went down the stairs into the playground, the oval, and so forth. Now, looking back, that classroom must have been a nightmare for Michael. The noise, the reverberation, like it was just on stilts. It must have, 25 children running around. Can you imagine the sensory overwhelm this little boy had? So it was very regular that he would run out of the room. And sometimes he would actually run to the equipment. Sometimes he'd try to run home to his nonna, which makes a lot of sense because she understood him. But for me, it was extremely stressful. And I'm sure both parents, teachers, aides, people listening tonight will know that stressful situation of where a child disappears. And as a teacher, it is extremely stressful when you've got other children you're also caring for. So for me, I had extremely limited support. In fact, if you looked on my website at all the resources we have, or you went into a specialist bookshop, You would find most of the books on autism were written after the 1990s, and this was the late 80s. This was over 20 years ago, when really we didn't have the knowledge and understanding of how to engage and help these children participate. There was no internet. It wasn't like I could go home and email or get on the internet. No mobile phones to call organisations. In fact, communication 20-odd years ago was very difficult. Now, I was very, very lucky. I was nominated an autism specialist who was just fantastic when I got to see her. But it was literally once a term, half an hour max, that I would get to speak to her. Now, some of you will laugh, but in between that, my only way of communicating with her was written letter. Now, parents, can you imagine having time to write a letter to a specialist and by the time you send it, it comes back? And teachers, when you've got so many kids in your class, having time to do that. You can imagine how hard that was. So I would try and do that and write a letter to say, can you help me? Michael's running out of the classroom. But by the time she'd write back, often the behaviour had changed. And this is the hard part with autism spectrum, that you get one thing working and then something else happens. So you need ongoing support. You need ongoing strategies. So I clearly remember driving home in term three and getting in my driveway and going, oh, we survived the day. Michael didn't pinch anyone, which was his little behaviour that he would use. And honestly, looking back, I suspect that's how Nonna communicated with him when he wasn't allowed to do something. So if children were doing things he didn't like, he would pinch them. He didn't cry. Now, his crying was very sensory. And in fact, he would start crying when we were doing noisy activities. I suspect the whole building was vibrating to him. I'm sure it was very scary for him. And big sobbing tears. And so this day, he hadn't cried, he hadn't pinched anyone, and he hadn't escaped. And I remember sitting in my driveway and going, yay, we got through the day. We had a good day. And in fact, when I had that thought, I felt sick, that I was just getting through the day, that I had no educational aims for this beautiful little boy, that just those three things that I was just, we got through the day, they weren't engagement, they weren't participation. They were just surviving in many ways. And I'm sure many of you listening to this call have had those days where you do just get through the day. But for me, I sat there that day in my car and I thought, Sue, what are you going to do to make it a success? To make it a success not just for Michael, for his nonna who didn't understand what she could do to help, for his parents, for the other children who didn't understand why Michael cried or pinched or ran away, for the whole community. And many of you have heard me say over the years, it takes a community to raise a child with autism. And I think if we're true to inclusion, we need everyone involved for inclusion to work. Anyway, in my car that day, I said to myself, what are you going to do to make it a success? And for me, that has been my passion for over 20 years. How do we make it a success? This led me to do my master's, which looked at the use of visuals for children with autism. I've now gone on to teach and support over 2,000 kids on the spectrum, and I'm still learning. But what I know is that my passion is how do we make it a success. And that's why I called my first book, Making a Success, which has over 500 ideas for engagement and participation. But all my books, and particularly that first one, are based on the three key philosophies I always wished I'd known when I taught Michael. And one was strategies wear out. See, I would go through a phase that things would actually work quite well for Michael, and I'd get him sitting on the mat with the other children, and I'd get him having a go at some things, but then that would stop working, and I'm sure many of you have experienced that. The next one is not every strategy works for every child. And I clearly remember this lovely visiting autism specialist recommending to me to make a masking tape square on the floor of the mat for Michael to sit in, for him to have that as his area. And it never worked, guys. He actually did not like that masking tape square. He came in and he ripped up that masking tape square. And then he put it back on the masking tape roll, because in his head it would have been, what's that doing there? That doesn't belong there. And he put it back on the masking tape and removed all the green carpet that was stuck in the masking tape. He must have been so frustrated by this masking tape square. But I put it back the next day because this expert told me to do it. And look, how do you know when to persist and when to be consistent? I don't really know. Sometimes it's a gut feel. But what I do know is not every strategy works for every kid. And that one didn't work for Michael. But what worked for him was his own little carpet square for him to sit on. And in fact, that little carpet square went for him with him from my classroom to many others. Right up to year five, he was still using that little carpet square. So sometimes strategies last for you. And the third and most important philosophy that underpins what I do is to know someone with autism or Asperger's, someone on the spectrum, is not to know autism or Asperger's. The spectrum is huge and every kid is different. And we need to appreciate that individualness. So it's not like you can just roll out one program for every kid. I would recommend you need to change it, be eclectic. And that's why in my books, for example, Getting a Kid to Sit, there's 10 ideas. Because strategies wear out, not every strategy works for every kid. Or for engaging in, say, journal writing or writing tasks, you know, there's 50 ideas. Or for the playground, or a child asking constant questions. I had a mum asking me about this week, you know, what about constant questions? And straight away I got out my book, Making a Success, and said, look, here are 10 ideas. Maybe one of those will work for your son. And she had a look and she goes, okay, tried that one. Haven't tried that one. And that's how I think my book should be used. Now, after writing my book, Making a Success, secondary school teachers said, oh, we want a book like that. So Anna Tullemans and I wrote the Essential Guide to Secondary School together. And Anna had experienced secondary not only as a parent of a son with Asperger's, but also as a teacher aide in schools and working in schools. So that book also had lots of practical strategies based on her experiences and mine in secondary settings. Now, the big change that happened in education for engagement and participation for kids is getting teacher assistants in classroom or teacher aides, education support officers. I'm not sure of all the different labels we use across the world for the people who come into our classrooms, but I call them angels because for me, I can't teach without a good angel in the room. What teacher assistants do is support engagement and participation. They're the one there that can highlight something, circle something, try out the strategies. Now, I can nearly hear you all sitting there going, but Sue, we don't get the hours we need. We don't have the aid time. I totally get that. But I didn't have 1 minute of aid time for Michael 20-odd years ago. So I think we've come a long way. I'm not saying that all kids get all the support they need. And in fact, for many kids on the spectrum, particularly our more passive kids, they often slip under the radar, and I really worry about those kids. And for me, you know, getting the right support can be very tricky. But I know for teachers out there, if you have the right angel in your room, it makes a world of difference to engagement. And for parents, sometimes knowing that their child has an aide with them in the room makes a world of difference too. And next week I'm interviewing Joe Atkins, whose son Joshua has one of the most amazing aides. And, you know, this is, if we can get the right aides for these kids, it just creates amazing engagement and participation. So hopefully, Joan, I'll talk a bit about that next week. Anyway, I then went on to write the Teacher Assistance Red Book of Ideas because in Australia, and what happened was we started, a lot of teacher assistants, what happened was, they were people who were part of school communities, often been volunteering for years in schools, who came in to help with students on the spectrum. But the challenge is that many aides hadn't done formal teacher training, although very skilled and very knowledgeable. So for many aides, Anna and I wrote this book to guide them and help them with engagement and participation. Because the reality is many aides are working with the kids who need the most support in learning, who need the most support to learn in classrooms. And that's tricky for teachers to engage these kids, let alone aides to do that. And the other thing we found is a lot of aides working in isolated in schools originally. There wasn't lots of aides in schools, so they often didn't have a network of resources. So that's what we tried to create. And this year we've put out the Teacher Assistant Blue Book, and I'm going to read you some excerpts from that tonight. And in the Teacher Assistant Blue Book, what we've, Anna and I found, so they're companion guides, they're completely different, is we talked to a lot of aides. In fact, we did some workshops with over 200 aides and found out from them their biggest challenges. And what we've done is tried to address in the blue book the things that weren't in the red book. But one of the big things that came up is that aides are working with kids with more and more complex diagnosis or dual diagnosis. So you might get autism and ADHD or ODD, oppositional defiance disorder, and Asperger's. So a lot of aides are working with a range of complex kids, and therefore we felt they needed more support. Okay, I'm going to start getting right on with what we're here for tonight. So I've just looked at my time timer and gone, gosh, 15 minutes have disappeared. But look, tonight, whether you're aiming for engagement and participation at school or home, I think there's some key things you can put in place. And what I've done, I've taken the letters in the word spectrum from autism spectrum, and we're going to use those to guide us to the things that need to be put in place. But before I get into those letters, I just want to say, it doesn't matter if you have a 3-year-old, a 13-year-old, a 23-year-old, they will need these strategies. Just like a child in a wheelchair needs a ramp or a wheelchair for life. It is the support, it is the strategy, it is the structure that makes a difference. And for many of our kids, people take these things away because they assume with age the child mightn't need these things. So I'd encourage you to really remember these are the things that create the independence. These are the things that are required to help these children engage. With all of these things I've written down, I have no doubt that kids on the spectrum's two biggest challenges to engagement and participation, whether it be a birthday party, whether it be activity in the community, families, whether it be a holiday, teachers for assembly, for learning tasks, their two biggest challenges are their anxiety and their difficulty with problem solving. So when I go through these tonight, I will be bringing up the fact that some of these things reduce anxiety and some help with helping with supporting problem solving. And for me, when people say to me, Sue, are there more kids diagnosed on the spectrum than ever before? I would say, actually, there are more kids diagnosed, but that doesn't mean these kids weren't around before, that they weren't in our schools. It's just schools were very structured, very routine. Schools didn't have collaborative and open learning. Schools were very different. And really, most schools didn't use a problem-solving curriculum. So, for example, when I went to school, the whole class would do the same assignment. The whole class would do the same spelling words. The readers were numbered 1, 2. When you read 1, you moved to 2, you moved to 3, or blue group, red group. Now there's a whole box of readers. How confusing must that be for this child? And often they choose the same reader every night, and I'm sure some parents have seen that. So let's have a look at this spectrum. So S is for schedules. We all use schedules. Just think of yourself today, knowing that you had to be ready for this call. You would have put in place some sort of timetables or schedules. But the reason we use schedules is they make life predictable. If you think about why, if I didn't give you a time for tonight, how stressful that would be. If I said, oh, you can join me any time on Thursday, I'll let you know closer what time. We actually give you a time so that you know what time it's going to be, to pre-warn you, to let you know. So what schedules do is they allow children time to know what's coming up, but also if there's a change in the schedule, letting them know that is really important too, because that helps with problem solving. So often, for example, on a rainy day at school, teachers will just say, oh, it's raining today, we might stay inside. What might be better to do is say, 5 minutes before lunchtime, there'll be an announcement that tells us that we're staying inside. So that creates certainty, whereas vagueness can make these kids very anxious. So even though you have a schedule, you might need to let them know when they're going to know about changes if you can't in advance. Families, one of the things I found very helpful when I work with families is putting in on a calendar, putting maybe photos or information about haircuts, visitors, long weekends. And most important schedule for every kid I know at home is knowing when they can do their special thing. When can they watch their Toy Story 2 video? So we're going to have a bath, eat dinner, then we can watch Toy Story. Because otherwise, this child will be constantly anxious, or if they're a child with limited communication, they'll be constantly going, turning the TV on, you'll be getting frustrated. Whereas if they know they're going to do this, this and this, then they're going to have their favourite show. There's no problem solving. They know what is expected. And the mistake many people make is assuming the child knows when things are going to happen, whereas this child likes that certainty. So actually having it on a visual schedule is really fantastic. And in fact, if you look on page 4 of the handout, you'll see the portable digital schedules, which I absolutely love. And they are a little timer at the top, and you'll see on page 4 they've got visuals attached. Now, the visuals don't come with it. You have to add your own, and you can see on the second one there's words, and you can just put words or you can put pictures. And what this does is you can tell the child how long they're going to spend on each activity. My actual experience is most children on the spectrum understand digital time because many of them love DVD players. So they've seen that little digital clock. They know what it means when it counts down or counts up. They know what a digital timer is because some of them love electronic equipment like microwaves that have that counting timer. So these are fantastic to add your schedules. Now, if you don't have visuals, in the last call I recommended the Pixapex that's on that page. It's a very cheap way to access visuals, whereas if you jump on the internet and look for visuals, you can spend hours looking for them, and a lot of them are far too busy for children on the spectrum. But something like a portable schedule is with a timer attached, very important. So our next letter is P, which is for processing time. And I would recommend you all have a set time to allow this child to process. So when you put a task in front of them, how long are you going to let them look at it before you prompt them to start? Because some children actually need a minute to look at that, to have a look at the whole task. So if you're working in early childhood, you put a puzzle in front of them, let them have time to process it. But what a lot of people do is start getting in their face, and then the child gets anxious, and often you'll see behaviour. Or people will tell the child to start work, and if they don't start work straight away, they'll start giving instructions rather than giving the child time. Now, in my experience, you give your verbal first, you know, Sue, write your name. If I don't write my name, you might give a prompt, like put the pencil in my hand. But don't keep repeating verbal instruction. If you've ever had someone repeating verbal instruction at you, you would call it nagging. And it's very important not to nag these kids. Give them time to engage and process. The other thing is, if you don't give them time to process, then they become very prompt dependent. They wait for you all the time. So it's worth giving instruction, walking away, and I have found over the years, you know whether they're focused or not, or whether they're distracted. So you'll work that out. But that, again, if you have a good teacher assistant, really important. And parents, you'll know the look in their eyes, whether they're focused or not. The next one is setting up for success. Now, many students on the spectrum have a huge fear of failure. And this is very much to do with their lack of problem solving. They can only see one way to do something. So if they make a mistake, they can't see another way. And this causes massive anxiety. In the Central Guide to Secondary, we've discussed this group. We call them Mr. Perfects. And in the big red book of ideas, we've included a whole section on fear of failure and strategies for teaching students what to do when they make a mistake. But I strongly believe making mistakes in front of this child and correcting it is so important. Talking through how you correct it. So I'd love all of you in the next 24 hours to purposely make a mistake. So teachers, you know, go into the classroom, call a child the wrong name, and then go, oh, no, that's okay. Everyone forgets names. What's your name again? You know, show how to correct a social mistake. Show how to correct when you're doing writing on the board, you know, make a spelling mistake and then talk about how you want, how instead of rubbing it out neatly like you would with a whiteboard rub or whatever, actually cross it out like you expect the students to do on their work and say, that's okay, everyone makes mistakes. Parents, you know, go shopping and say, oh, there's something I had to get. What was it? I've forgotten. Some of you won't have to practice that one. It'll naturally come to you. But what I want you to do is really practice verbally saying, that's okay. Everyone makes mistakes. I can fix this, and explain how you'll fix it. Because what we tend to do as adults, make mistakes in front of these kids. We fix it up, but they don't see that. They don't understand how we've fixed it, and then they become thinking they have to be perfectionists. If I've got a secondary school teacher listening, please, please show this kid another kid's work that's maybe not the perfect kid. Don't show them the A grade, because then they think that's what they have to hand in. Show them maybe a D or someone who got 51%. You know, show them the range that can be handed in, because many of these kids are aiming for 100%. Over the years, I've seen many kids, because of this fear of failure, disengage in learning. And I actually call that why bother syndrome. Why bother trying if I'm going to fail? Why bother having a go if the teacher's going to put a big red cross on that? So please, model making mistakes. Reward the child for making mistakes. In fact, I have heaps of kids who are using the token systems, and we give them a token every time they make a mistake or have a go or cross out a word rather than putting a hole in their page, which many of you would have seen. So every time they correct things and not get anxious about it, then we're rewarding them. So this is self-regulation, and we have to aim for that. But it's why so many kids love computers, because they can delete mistakes without anyone knowing they made the mistake in the first place. C, communication. So when we're talking to kids on the spectrum, because of their limited processing time, you do need to limit instructions and not verbally overwhelm them. I'd also recommend women listening that you're very careful with your tone of voice. Kids on the spectrum, Asperger's kids, tend to use a monotone tone of voice. And it is hypothesized and thought that's because these kids hear that tone of voice best, that middle range. My theory is that's why these kids often respond best to males, to their dads, to principals, to men, to grandpa, because grandpa uses that middle tone. I also think men don't waffle on nearly as much as women. So men tend to just say, Jack, sit down, whereas women will go, Jack, I've asked you 5 times to sit down. Too many words to process. So very important. The other thing, which many of you have heard me say before, is please put their name at the start of the sentence. This will halve their processing time, but also help their brain process the communication. So if you say, everyone sit on the mat, Jack probably won't sit on the mat. And if he doesn't respond to everyone, then say, Jack, sit on the mat. There's been a whole lot of really interesting research around this that shows that actually recognising your name is fight or flight. So many of you would have been out in the crowd, someone says your name, and you turn around without even thinking about it. So what the research seems to indicate is if you say the child with autism's name at the start of the sentence, it's like getting a spark plug going in their mind. But I know many of you have heard me talk about that before. But the next and most important thing around communication is how literal these kids are. And often our communication confuses them. So a teacher will say to a child, can you sit down? Now, you've said can. So now the child thinks that's a choice. So they'll say no. And then people will think the child's been rude, because you didn't really mean can you sit down. You meant sit down. Now, there is this fantastic book on page 3 called What Did You Say, What Did You Mean? And it's a whole lot of metaphors and figurative speech that it is amazing how many of these kids do not know what people are saying to them. So on the front cover you can see 2 kids with a ball and it says, they had a ball. Now, a child on the spectrum might visualise they actually had a bouncy ball. But that's not what people meant. They meant we had fun. So imagine how confusing that would be, and you do need to explicitly teach this to kids on the spectrum, but assuming they know. And I've seen many examples over the years where people say hop on the bus and the child will hop, where kids are told to pull up their socks and they're pulling up their socks. I'm sure many of you listening have beautiful examples of their literalness. And again, this is where we have to be very careful with our communication. The next thing is T for time frames. And this links very closely with the first thing I spoke about, which is schedules. And really, they need to be used together. And this is a key strategy to reduce anxiety. So I thought I'd read to you from the big blue book of ideas on page 24, the use of timers and clocks, because this really sums up why we do this. So on page 24, we say, we all use time to guide us and organise our day. Teaching students to use timers and clocks helps them with their organisational skills. So as you can see, time is a key part with helping children with their organisation, but not only that, with their transition and planning. The most important reason we use timers and clocks is to allow them to know when and how long they're going to do an activity. Because you say they can go on the computer, but they don't know how long for. Can you understand that's a problem-solving thing? That other children know how long, but this child all can sort of guess, or you can just say to them, okay, time to get off, or give them a 1 minute warning. But many children on the spectrum need longer than that because of their processing time. So this is called pre-warning. So timers and clocks give them that pre-warning. We've included about 10 different ideas for using timers and clocks. And the first one is to pre-warn them to start and finish activities. The next is to actually move them from one activity to the next. So parents, I think that's really important, from home to school, from their special favourite activity to joining something with the family or doing something you want. So we're going to watch TV, then we're going to clean our teeth. That's where timers can be fantastic. In the book, we've said to let them know how long they can do a task for. Now, I use that for tasks they like and don't like. Also, I find timers are fabulous for building independence and personal transition. And particularly if you don't have a teacher assistant in the room, you will need to use timers to help the child manage their own time, to regulate their own progression through the day. Timers also create predictability and structure. So we have many kids who constantly ask, what time's morning tea? When's morning tea? Or how long till we can go inside? So actually using a timer keeps their anxiety down and helps calm them. And also for turn-taking, particularly if they want something someone else has, giving them how long they have to wait will stop a lot of arguments. And if you use the time timers, they're so visual. If you say in 10 minutes it's your turn for the computer, the child on the spectrum can visually see that and won't constantly ask. And if they ask, you can just point to the timer. There's a lovely example in the teacher assistant book, the big blue book of ideas, and it's this one. Kevin didn't like handwriting lessons and he would become extremely anxious. Once the time timer was used to show the lesson only went for 20 minutes, he was able to participate and stop asking, how much longer do I have to do this? Now, I think parents, homework, again, put in place your time frames. Don't get them doing hours of homework, maybe 15 minutes homework, 15 minutes something they want to do. 15 minutes, break it up. Make it, you know, instead of dragging out, really break it up for them. Next is R for repeating activities. And look, most kids on the spectrum, it's one of the first things parents notice about this child often, and teachers, that they love repetition, whether it's a DVD, movement, a constant conversation, or an activity they love. And giving students repetitive routines and activities actually really reduces their stress. But also, if you have a routine, there's no problem solving. If you know where you sit, what you have to do, where you stand in the line, then there's no problem solving and therefore reduces anxiety. So repetitive activities and routines are vital for building independence and increasing confidence and success. Imagine if every day you turned up at your job and there was something different happening. And we all love repetition and activities. So when you do repetition, it increases your engagement and participation. And in fact, when I went to school, we did a lot of rote repetition. We did a lot of repetitive activities. And if parents, you know, and teacher assistants, you know, sometimes if the child's really struggling with a homework task, I would recommend asking that you do it over a couple of weeks or repeat the activity, because very often they don't learn anything because they're so anxious about the new activity and they don't know what to do. But if you repeat it, then they can predict more what's happening and feel more confident. The next one is understanding. Now, of course, understanding the individualness of the student is one thing, but also understanding that they are visual learners. And very often, kids on the spectrum are visual learners, but people don't realise that they can read all this information, hyperlexia. They can read it, and I've written about this in my book, Making Success. They can read, but they don't comprehend. Or they can repeat back slabs of information, but they don't understand. So this is why we use visuals, to support what we're asking kids to do. Because although they might be able to repeat it back or read it, do they understand? So always check for understanding. Because there are many students on the spectrum who say, yes, they know what to do, you wander off and you come back and they haven't done any work because they really didn't understand the task. And I also have many children who don't like asking for help. And that can be an issue because they will sort of fake that they understand and really don't understand what's required. And many of you would have seen this, and it often results in meltdowns. And last but not least, motivate and reward. Now, the way I look at it, kids on the spectrum are adult learners. Many of you would not go to work unless you got paid. And imagine if your boss said to you, right, we're going to pay you once a year. Would you lose motivation pretty quickly? Would you sort of, oh gosh, got a week, 52 weeks to get paid? Well, that's how school is for many kids on the spectrum. They have to put in all this effort for no payday. So most people get paid weekly, fortnightly, monthly, because I suppose psychologists have found that means people stay motivated. Well, for me, kids on the spectrum need lots of paydays, and you need to make sure that you're providing lots of motivation of things they like. So imagine if your boss said to you, look, I'm not going to pay you this week. I'm just going to give you a bag of apples. That mightn't be very interesting for you. Imagine if you don't like apples. Because at school, sometimes people say, oh, I'm going to put a sticker on his work. Well, for some kids on the spectrum, they don't want that sticker on their work. Well, that good stamp, if it smudges a little bit, that can make them anxious. So we need to find what motivates the kid. Now, the reason you get given money is you get to choose what to do with your own money. For me, we need to give kids time. That's their payday, time doing what they like. And for some kids, that can change daily. For some kids, it's the same Bob the Builder thing every day, or Ben 10 or Lego. But I really believe you have to do small achievable tasks, quick reward. Small achievable task, quick reward. Waiting a whole day just causes massive anxiety for this kid, and often they can't get to the end of the day because it's just too far away. So you'll need to judge that for yourself. If you're working with very young children, I would recommend, you know, one activity you want, so maybe do the puzzle, then the child can draw their Pokemon for 5 minutes, you know, read a book, draw their Pokemon. As they get older, you know, 25 minutes work, we're going to do this, this and this, and you'd have a schedule showing what they're going to do, and then their 5 minute reward. And then 25 minutes work, 5 minute reward. I would prefer over an hour, a child had two lots of 5 minute rewards than an hour's work for a 10 minute reward. But you can work it out depending on the kid. But particularly if you've got kids disengaged, I promise you, try giving them quicker rewards. So parents at home, 10 minutes homework, 5 minute reward. 10 minutes come and read a book, 5 minutes you can play on your favourite computer game. Now, if you're using computers as their reward, make sure the games can be paused. Please don't buy games that can't be paused, because if you can't pause the game, you won't get them off after 5 minutes. Now, the key is when you're moving to them from the reward back to the activity you want them to do, you need to tell them before. Put on the timer so they know how long. So you need a schedule that'll say puzzle, draw Ben 10, reading, draw Ben 10, writing, draw Ben 10, so they can see the schedule and pattern of rewards and work. When people do activity reward and don't tell them what they're going to go on after the reward, then they get very anxious, because they don't hear you often. They're so absorbed in the task they're doing, they don't want to stop. So having the timer, having the schedule, all these things make the world of difference to helping kids on the spectrum engage and participate. So I'm hoping tonight that you've got lots of practical ideas, and I really just want to thank you all for taking the time for listening in. And as I say, this is such a passion for me that if there's anyone listening who's had one of those days where they felt they just got through the day, please just try one of these strategies tomorrow. You know, introduce a schedule, introduce a timer, look at making mistakes in front of the kid. I'm sure that if you just try one or two of these things, you'll see a big difference. I've shared with you a range of strategies to increase engagement and participation. And many of you know my books. And just a reminder, there are hundreds more ideas in there to try. And in all my books, what I try and put is the stuff I wished I had known when I first started in autism and things that I see over and again working with these kids in schools, families. But as I said to you at the beginning of the call, look, strategies wear out and not every strategy works for everybody. So I don't expect you to like everything I say, and some of you, there'll be things I said tonight, you're like, no, it didn't work for me, and it mightn't. But you know the funny thing? Over the years, I've had where a strategy doesn't work, and then a year later, I come and I see the same kid, and I try that same strategy that didn't work a year ago, and it works. So please, don't throw strategies away forever. Maybe just put them away for a while and then get them back out. So I really encourage you to revisit my books, as sometimes it is a great prompt of different strategies to try. I hope you've enjoyed the call, and I'm really looking forward to chatting with you on my Facebook now for the next hour or so. Can I ask that you actually post your questions in the public area? Because last time I was trying to answer personal questions in the messages and the public area, and I found that really tricky. So what I would actually ask is if you do have a personal question or email that you're not comfortable putting up publicly, which I totally understand, can I ask that you go to my website? And my lovely husband has just given me a little note saying the website is now back up. We were having some technical issues before the call, but I'm hoping that you can all get online now. And you can actually email me. When you go to my website, it says email Sue. And if you send me your questions that way, I actually find that a lot easier to respond than through Facebook messages. With Facebook messages, I get a lot of messages that I guess are junk messages, whereas through my website, I actually can filter those and get back to you. So just go to www.suelarkey, that's suelarkey.com, and it says email Sue. So I look forward to hearing from you. Look, I love getting your questions and feedback. It always inspires me to hear from people. So, and the fact that you're listening in, I really appreciate it. And also, don't forget to download any of my free tip sheets from my website. We're always putting up new tip sheets, and I'm hoping that all of those can help make it a success for not just the child, but other children. Like, have a look at the promoting awareness tip sheet, which helps other children understand the kids, and that's the sort of stuff I wished I'd known when I had Michael, to help the other children understand him too. So for all of you, I just wish you the best to make it a success, and thank you very much for listening into this call tonight, and I'll be on Facebook. Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.